From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Jacob Phillips.
This week on War News Radio, we're covering from war. We first take a look at the looting of the Iraqi Museum of Modern Art during the fall of Baghdad and the efforts it has taken to restore the art. Then we hear about the efforts of one group to memorialize the historic book-selling center of Baghdad, Al-Mutanabi Street, which was destroyed after a car bombing in 2007. Finally, we hear survival stories from Iraqi women who are subjected to human trafficking. But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Libyan rebels dissolved their cabinet this week in an effort to silence unrest inside the revolutionary movement after the recent death of the movement's military leader, Abdel Fattah Younes. National Council member Fatih Turbel says that the move is linked to mistakes made by the cabinet following Younes' death. Turbel, however, did not specify what these mistakes were. Younes' tribe, the Obeidi, has been outspoken in advocating for the council to investigate the mysterious circumstances surrounding the general's death. According to a spokesman, the rebels' Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril will retain his job, but the rest of the cabinet must be filled by appointees confirmed by the National Transitional Council. As it will be some time before the appointees are confirmed, the rebels are left with several vacancies in key leadership positions.
The controversy surrounding a NATO attack on a Libyan television station last month is growing. Libyan officials say 3 journalists were killed and 15 others were wounded when the station's satellite dishes were attacked. UNESCO, the UN's educational, science, and cultural organization, has publicly denounced the attack, saying NATO violated a UN Security Council resolution created to protect journalists and media sources during conflict, and also the Geneva Convention, which protects journalists, even those involved in propaganda, during war. However, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon believes NATO's airstrike was justified in its attempt to protect civilians. Similarly, NATO defends the airstrike, arguing that the television network is used by the Gaddafi regime to incite attacks on civilians and oppress and threaten them. NATO has rejected criticism about the airstrike, saying there is no evidence that anyone was hurt and that the intent was never to hurt anyone in the first place.
Muqtada al-Sadr, the prominent anti-American Shiite cleric, issued a warning to U.S. troops that may stay after the U.S. military withdrawal deadline on December 31, 2011. In the statement on his website, Sadr threatened that he would order his followers to attack any American troops that remain past the end of the year. The statement comes as American and Iraqi officials begin detailed talks over shifting the approaching deadline. In order to ease tensions, the Iraqi government hopes to emphasize that any remaining American forces are military trainers, not combat soldiers.
The Taliban shot down a helicopter in eastern Afghanistan, killing 30 U.S. troops and 8 Afghans. The rocket-propelled grenade fired by the Taliban caused the single deadliest attack on U.S. troops in the 10-year war in Afghanistan. Those killed included 22 sailors, of whom 17 were Navy SEALs. They were not on a rescue mission, as previously reported, but rather were targeting Mullah Mohibullah, who was leading a group of over 10 Taliban insurgents through the Tangi Valley that evening. Several of the insurgents began to flee, and U.S. Marine Corps General John R. Allen stated that while focused on stopping the Taliban escape, the insurgents shot down the helicopter. Allen also mentioned that those Taliban fighters who were responsible for the helicopter crash were killed in a U.S. airstrike soon after.
This is War News Radio. In the chaos following the fall of Baghdad in 2003, looters ransacked the city. Perhaps some of the most tragic events included the looting of Iraq's museums and galleries, where priceless pieces of Iraqi history were stolen or damaged beyond repair. With chaotic government and little funding to go around, smaller institutions like the Iraqi Museum of Modern Art were left without support and came to depend upon individuals and informal organizations to recover the collection. Sarah Dwyder spoke to curators, artists, and art historians in the U.S. and Iraq about grassroots efforts and the progress they've made.
In the spotlight of international media, the 2003 looting of the Iraqi Museum of Antiquities became a symbol of post-invasion chaos. However, despite its high-profile position, the Museum of Antiquities was not the only arts institution left devastated by looting. The Iraqi Museum of Modern Art, dedicated to exhibiting the work of Iraq's modern and contemporary artists, as well as artists from around the Middle East, lost most of its extensive collection of art to looters. Professor Nada Shaboud, an art historian from the University of Texas who focuses on Iraqi modern art, says that just gaining recognition for the museum has been a struggle.
I would go give a lecture about, you know, the state of the modern museum, and people immediately think that there was a typo in the announcement, because, of course, I will be talking about the Museum of Antiquities. And many actually were shocked to discover that there was an Iraqi Museum of Modern Art, that there was modern art in Iraq.
Looters made off with most of the collection of Iraqi modern art, an estimated 7,000 pieces. There has been almost no government support for the recovery and restoration process. Instead, Iraqi artists and their supporters organized their own efforts to recover looted work, and at their own expense. They inquired about missing works, combed through the markets and galleries of Baghdad, and negotiated for their return. For the artists, this was an effort not only to salvage an institution, but to preserve Iraqi heritage, which they felt had come under attack during the invasion. Today, although the museum still functions at only half capacity, with a large part of its collection still missing, the doors are open to the public. Professor Shaboud believes that this disparity in awareness played a large part in the recovery process, or lack thereof. While the Museum of Antiquities received the support of the FBI and UNESCO, the Iraqi Museum of Modern Art was left with little to no outside support.
For the National Museum of Modern Art, it was a very different story. The archive disappeared. There was just no control. So some of the artworks were looted. Some were destroyed on site. People didn't know the value of it yet.
Professor Shaboud says that there is a gap in the perceived value of ancient and modern art.
Because there's always a hot market for it. For modern art, and because modern art of the whole region is not that known, and it has never been recorded in terms of writing an art history book as we understand it here in the West. So you'd hear rumors about, you know, someone in one of the provinces selling a truckload of modern art, you know, that you had to buy without seeing.
Before the looting, despite relative international obscurity, the museum had been an important cultural institution in Iraq. Salam Atasabri, the current director of the Museum of Modern Art, says that the collection not only showcased developments in Iraqi art, but Middle Eastern art as a whole.
It's their heritage, cultural heritage, and it's international museum. It's also, we had many famous Middle Eastern from Lebanon, from Jordan, from Morocco. So it was international collection also, beside the pioneers, Iraqi, the biggest collection it was. And still we got one of the very famous collections in the Middle East now, especially the pioneers, Iraqi pioneers.
However, the Museum of Modern Art was more than just an exhibition space. According to Isam Pasha, an Iraqi artist who grew up in Baghdad, the museum provided a complete art center for the public.
Before the wars and since the 80s, we have what's called Saddam Art Center, and it's a big center. The government has built it early in the 80s. Actually, to become a mall, but one of the artists that was close to Saddam asked him for this big building, 8-floor building, to turn into an art center. So it was a house for the National Iraqi Modern Art Museum, the National Graphic Museum. It has the laboratories to fix artworks and, reserve artworks and photograph artworks too. It was a whole complete big center with the big library, archive for the artists, and countless museums.
Because of its comprehensive role as an art center, many artists like Pasha felt that the Museum of Modern Art played a critical role in their development as artists.
I mean, I used to go there when I was a student in high school and still try to practice art and learn about art. You meet up with a lot of artists. You have the exhibitions there. You can learn and see examples of what you have learned. You can start developing a taste. If you have any question about anything or you want to read about it, at that time there was no internet, so you would just go to the library, and that was very important, and start reading about things.
However, after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, this cultural institution was completely decimated. Professor Chabot says that the looting resulted in the damage of many of the artworks.
Reports were telling us that some canvases were cut and the wood was taken and the canvas was thrown or vice versa, and so they were damaged in the process.
Pasha adds that the looting took its toll on the museum building itself.
I went past by it a few times in separate, like, few weeks right after the invasion. And in the end, the last time I went by it, even the marble was stolen from the floors and from the walls. Everything was stolen. The building was basically stripped out of everything.
Without government or international support, it seemed that the museum would never be able to recover its collection. Professor Chabot attempted to solicit several charitable organizations for support with no success.
The Ministry of Culture, the Italian Embassy people, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, no one was willing to put up any money. And I kind of, you know, followed up on this and tried contacting people after that, trying to see if there's any funds to buy back, for instance, looted work.
Professor Chabot says no organization would provide the needed funds to repurchase art from looters.
Kind of sort of like, you know, negotiating with terrorists, you know, concept that we don't negotiate with terrorists and so we can't buy back looted work. They have to return it willingly. And of course, no one was returning it willingly, but particularly that there is no enforcement of any sort.
However, according to Chabot, in the months following the looting, artists who had strong ties to the museum began to organize to search for these looted works.
Of course, all the artists have been very cooperative because many of the artists know what works they had there. And some of them even know what works the pioneers, who are no longer alive, had there, because this was a very important place in the development of modern Iraqi art. Because imagine, during the sanctions where they couldn't even get magazines like Art Forum or anything else, this was the only place where they can go for inspiration.
Chabot says these ties motivated artists to seek out the lost works.
Some of the artists kind of formed a coalition and went around looking for works on the streets and the market. They saw rumors and were in fact able to purchase back some of the important works.
Isam Pasha was among the artists participating in the recovery process.
I'm one of a lot of Iraqi artists and art lovers and art critics that recovered and worked on recovering Iraqi artworks. Not only Iraqi artworks, international artworks, actually. There are some gallery owners that started to collect them and gave them back to the Iraqi Ministry of Culture.
According to Pasha, these grassroots efforts had an international reach as even Iraqi artists living abroad tried to track down works smuggled out of the country.
It's a long process, and luckily a lot of people are involved with very, very good intentions and positive activities to bring them back. And I believe a lot of it was brought back. The last I checked was about one-third was brought back. It was pure personal work to bring back the Iraqi heritage.
With government corruption and a stunted economy still hindering recovery in Iraq, it is efforts like those of the Iraqi arts community which offer the most hope for rebuilding and growth.
Well, my hope is the next generation will come and see the Iraqi heritage is back. Maybe not 100%, but whatever we can get. And the school of from kindergarten up to universities as a group visitors. I hope that will happen for my daughters and for the next generation. We are doing the best we can, and we hope we can do much for the next generation. The museum is part of the Iraqi, big part of the Iraqi heritage.
With this restoration, the Iraqi Museum of Modern Art has reopened its collection to the public. Director Atta Sabri sees the reopening and the cooperation that led to the recovery of its missing work as hopeful steps for Iraqi's heritage and future. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Dwider.
This is War News Radio. In 2007, a car bomb was detonated on Al-Mutanabi Street, Baghdad's unofficial center of literature and bookstores. The attack resulted in the complete destruction of the street and its countless books. Today, a group started in the United States called the Al-Mutanabi Street Coalition is calling for submissions for a book art exhibit which will commemorate all that was lost in the bombing. Clara Izupidis takes a look at the group's work and the importance of Al-Mutanabi Street to people all over the world.
Stemming off Baghdad's historic Al-Rashid Street is Al-Mutanabi Street, a winding alley known for its many bookstores. Named after a 10th century Iraqi poet, Al-Mutanabi, the street is packed with bookshops on both sides and is home to many writers, poets, and thinkers who come together and converse over coffee at the local cafe. Mohammed Al-Saidi, a native Iraqi and a current student studying biology at the University of Texas at Austin, describes his memories of the street.
And the reason it was one of my favorite spots was because, you know, all throughout my life, I just went there a lot of times and just got all different kinds of books, and you see all different kinds of people there as well.
Al-Saidi explains how Al-Mutanabi Street has allowed people from all backgrounds to relate on a different level.
It's a place where all different kinds of people go without any problems, and they just go there and they're basically united by their love for reading and new information.
But 4 years ago, a car bomb exploded on Al-Mutanabi Street. The explosion left nearly 30 dead and 100 injured. The street was almost completely decimated, destroying the books themselves, as well as challenging the ideas behind them. Al-Mutanabi Street was reopened in 2008, and efforts continue to recover and revive what was lost in the bombing. One of the forces behind those efforts is the Al-Mutanabi Street Coalition, a group based in the United States and started by Beau Beausoleil, a poet and bookseller in San Francisco. The group began with a call for artists to create broadsides, posters made with a letterpress printer. And now, they are currently making a call for submissions of book art, artistic representations of the books lost on Al-Mutanabi Street. But Beausoleil explains how the books and the pieces of book art represent something much greater.
And I thought, part of this project is the idea of responding to this attack on books, that why not ask artist bookmakers to create some books as a memorial to Al-Mutanabi Street, and as also as something that would try and get at the idea both of the fragility of books and the strength of books as well, and how this attack ultimately could not take away the ideas within those books.
The Al-Mutanabi Street Coalition has asked artists to take 1 year to create 3 pieces of book art, a call which ends in September of this year. Their first show will feature 200 pieces of book art and will be held at the John Ryland Library in Manchester, England. Beausoleil says that each of the book art shows will be accompanied by a reading by local writers, who will read their own work, as well as works from Iraqi and other Middle Eastern authors. After the reading, they will begin discussions about the meaning of the books and the idea of Al-Mutanabi Street. What is the idea of Al-Mutanabi Street exactly? There are many, but several themes begin to emerge. Azar Nafizi, author of the best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran, and Things I've Been Silent About, has an essay in the coalition's forthcoming anthology and describes her idea of Al-Mutanabi Street.
For me, Al-Mutanabi Street presented to the world an alternative view of looking at Iraq, which humanized Iraq. Which made people who have never been to Iraq, who have lived 5,000 miles, thousands of miles away from Baghdad, understand that Iraqi people are like the rest of us. And they have the same feelings, the same emotions, they suffer, and they become human beings, individuals, rather than people who are ruled by Saddam Hussein. And later, people who are defined by a foreign invasion.
Nafizi finds that many Westerners have difficulty relating to the Iraqi people, as the country has been reduced into one aspect, the political aspect. While she describes us as being too reliant on television and talking heads, Nafizi sees Al-Mutanabi Street as a connector between Iraq and the rest of the world.
You have a bookstore there that was gutted and destroyed by the bomb, called the Renaissance Bookstore. In that bookstore, you had books by communists and clerics side by side with translations from Shakespeare. So that small bookstore represented the whole world, and it connected Iraq to the world and the world to Iraq in a way that politics never does.
Beausoleil says that as a poet and a bookseller, even from 5,000 miles away, he felt that connection to Al-Mutanabi Street.
When this bombing happened, I knew immediately that if I was an Iraqi, as a poet and a bookseller, Al-Mutanabi Street would be my street. That's where my bookstore would be. These would be my people, my cultural community. And I felt that direct connection, and I felt that immediate kind of wound.
The Al-Mutanabi Street Coalition has adopted the slogan, Al-Mutanabi Street Starts Here, a phrase summing up both the idea of Al-Mutanabi Street as a connector between Iraq and the world, as well as why it should be important to non-Iraqis. Beausoleil explains how and why Al-Mutanabi Street can start here.
It's really something I've come to feel is that anywhere someone sits down with a book to read or picks up a pen and paper to write, that it is there that Al-Mutanabi Street starts, and that an attack like this is ultimately an attack on all of us, that it needs constant vigilance, and it needs for this project to continue.
After all of the book art submissions come in, which Beausoleil expects to happen by the fall of 2012, the exhibit will begin its tour. He hopes that the exhibit will be a connector between the world and Iraq, and that viewers will see the exhibit as a vehicle for their own voices, and remember that Al-Mutanabi Street starts here. For War News Radio, I'm Clara Izupitis.
This is War News Radio. Breaking the binds of silence is the first step toward the healing process for victims of violence, exploitation, and sexual abuse. Dina Sherhan spoke with Yanar Mohammed, the head of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, about the stories of struggle and survival to combat human trafficking in Iraq.
Yanar Mohammed, the head of the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, tells the story of a woman named Hind, an Iraqi human rights activist who was once trafficked until she was saved by Ofi.
There was an activist called Hind. She joined us in the year 2007. She stayed in our shelter for almost a year and a half. She began to do the outreach for us. She knows the location of the biggest brothels in Baghdad because she has been in most of them, or her women friends are living in those or running them.
Ofi was established in 2003 in Baghdad to offer shelter and to work with Iraqi women and girls who have been exploited for labor and sex, both within the nation and internationally. Mohammed explains that the relationships with Hind and other survivors of human trafficking have been critical for finding information about brothels in Baghdad and other Iraqi cities, because the government does not play any role in helping. Hind now works full-time with Ofi. Mohammed explains that the average time for sheltering a survivor is usually 1 year, during which Ofi offers the women classes in English literacy and computer skills. Mohammed tells us the story of another human trafficking survivor, and now an activist, keeping her anonymous for her own safety.
One of them who we kept is now an IT consultant with a few non-governmental organizations. She can handle any software that a civil society organization would need. She gets a very good salary, something that's almost equivalent to what a Western woman would get. She is an outreach personnel, and she's one of the most outspoken feminists in the city of Baghdad now. The controversy is that she still cannot show her face on TV because if her tribe can locate her, she would be killed.
If a survivor cannot work in Iraq due to security or any other reason, Mohammed says that she would be eligible for what they call the Underground Railroad for Iraqi Women. The program gets survivors with critical cases out of the country. For example, those survivors whose families have threatened them with honor killing. Once the survivors are out of Iraq, they can apply to get refugee status through UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. Mohammed tells us the tragic story of a 17-year-old survivor who left for Jordan through this program. while also keeping her anonymous for her own safety.
Her family house was exploded. She was the only one who survived, adopted by stranger. And by the time she began to grow up, they began to approach her. And she found herself running from one house to the other. She managed to leave the trafficking circle. She fell in love with a young man. She made a family with him, but left the country and went to live in Jordan.
Muhammad explains that even though living far away, survivors are still attacked periodically by their relatives and traffickers, who reach them by phone or through social media.
So one of them did end up in Australia. We still write to each other on Facebook. It's very hard for some of them to have a really simple, forward, and successful life. She is on my Facebook and she still runs into trouble.
Muhammad also explains that not all survivors of human trafficking succeed in forgetting about their pasts and building new lives.
With almost 20% of the women, there was no success because other issues were involved, like addiction, like being attached to a person or a group inside the trafficking ring. We learned that some of those challenges were bigger than us, that we could not handle them.
Muhammad tells us the story of Sahar, a human trafficking victim who was rescued by Ofi, but has not been able to recover from her haunting experiences.
One of the first cases that we took in, she was handed over by a female American soldier to us. We were told that she was heavily abused at home, that when she reached to them, parts of her head were crushed and she was beaten heavily. She stayed with us for some time, but later on we found out that there was a part of her history that she did not disclose, which was 2 years in a brothel.
According to Muhammad, Ofi helped Sahar learn how to read and write in a short period of time, but could not overcome all of her problems.
She had addiction on hallucination pills in addition to alcohol. When Sahar was able to learn reading and writing, and she was a very nice woman, she honestly tried to change her life around, but her problem was with addiction and she fell into it again. She's back into the brotheling circles now.
Muhammad explains that the most difficult cases are when victims are both illiterate and afflicted with severe depression, because she says psychotherapy is usually not effective. Muhammad tells the story of Ahud as an example.
We took her to a therapist and she had 1-2 sessions which made no sense to her at all. She would still be depressed. She would try to get alcohol and drink abundantly.
Ofi, like other NGOs, has helped dozens of survivors forget about their past, heal, and reintegrate in society. However, there are still many other victims like Sahar and Ahud. Medical and psychological support have not met their needs, eliminated their addictions, or other related effects of the traumatic experience. For World News Radio, I'm Dina Shirhan.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew for this week includes Clara Izupidis and Stuart Russell. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Jacob Phillips.
And I'm Eliana Biscard Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.